Great. So, as I said, we're moving on to our second Mishnah now in Bo'akama. This is Tetlamadet 9b, about seven lines from the top. And the Mishnah is written in a similar sort of style to the first one, where it's a little bit different language. The language is a little bit different. I think one of the later authorities, I think Maritz Chayas or somebody, says that this was a Mishnah that was written in a different area or different style, and was sort of conglomerated. So again, just the language is a bit more bitty, I suppose, than a usual Mishnah. But either way, hopefully we'll make our way through it, and then the Gemara will explain it, as always. So, Kol Shechavti Bishmiroso, Hichsharti Es Nizko. So it seems to be talking in the first person here. Anybody who I am anything I am liable to watch over, Shmira, to be in charge of it, to watch it carefully, then Hichsharti Et Nizko. I have, the literal translation of this is almost to prepare, Lachshir is to prepare something. I prepared its damages, i.e., it's almost like you know you have to be ready, expectant that you will have to pay damages for that thing which you are expected to be watching. And the Mishnah continues. Hichsharti nizko. Hichsharti b'miktzas nizko. Let's say I was just prepared to for part of it, right? What if I only felt that I was liable for a bit of it? Chavti b'tashlumei nizko. So again, the Gemara is going to clarify this, but the Mishnah, at least in this, you know, simple statement, says chavti b'tashlumei nizko kehechsher kol nizko, that you're liable for everything. There's no such thing as half measures here. When you if you're taking on part of it, then you're taking on the whole thing. Okay, so there's no such thing as half measures here. Now the Mishnah moves on and it begins to talk about the types of objects which get damaged, or the types of property which get damaged, which would be liable to pay, for a payment. Anything which does not require payment of ma'ila. Ma'ila is when the person takes something from Hekdesh, something which belongs to the temple, or similar to that. And so those sorts of things, as we mentioned before, we actually saw a debate about that a little bit earlier, I think on 6, on Daf Rav, if I remember correctly. But at least the Mishnah over here seems to be going with the opinion that anything which is Hekdesh is not liable to pay, you damage something from Hekdesh. And this is, again, we're talking about inadvertent damages here. So then you wouldn't be liable to pay. Nechasim shehin shel b'nei bris. So we're talking about the only liable to pay damages for those who are part of the covenant, okay? This is a Gemara, again, which goes into it later. So we'll leave it for later. It talks about the liability to pay for non-Jews, and actually the reverse as well. Sorry, not just non-Jews. We're talking about, very possibly more specifically, idolaters. That's part of the discussion later on. And again, the Gemara discusses whether we're talking about which directed both directions. Okay, so liability for a Jew to pay for an idolater, and so too in reverse. Idolater's damages towards a Jew. So again, that's the Mishnah here. Gemara later on. And again, over here we're talking about where it has to be objects or something which has an owner, not just something which is lying out in the street. This is to exclude nechosim shel hefker. I think Rashi says that. Rashi says sheyesh lahem ba'alim. Okay, this is the Rashi towards the bottom of the Amud, sort of the about 10 skinny lines up, 10 of the thin lines, the thinnest lines, about 10 lines from the end of the thin lines. He says, they have to have an owner, la'afuke the hefker, to exclude those which are hefker, which are ownerless. She'im hizakti nechasim the hefker hutur. If I accidentally cause damage to property of hefker, then I am not liable, I'm exempt. So those are the three exceptions that the Gemara throws in, that the Mishnah throws in here. Sorry, back in the Mishnah, uva chol makom, and in any place, not really any place, chutz, except for Nirashus Hamiyuchedes Lamazik, if it's on the property of the damager, the person who caused it, or the person whose property caused the damage, then that's you're exempt from that. Okay, you're exempt from that. So for why? So again, Rashi clarifies because She'im nichnas shara shal nizak birushut hamazik. If the again, this is right towards the end, the last Rashi on the skinny lines. Because if the ox of the nizak of the person who had the damage caused comes into your field, v'hizika shara shal mazik, and then my ox gores them, potter, I'm exempt. Amarle torcha birushusi, my boy, what is your ox doing in my field, right? The fact that it's there is why it ended up getting damaged, and therefore I would not be liable as a result of that. In addition to that, urushus hamnizak, back in the Mishnah, urushus hamnizak v'hamazik, if they have a joint field or a joint property, nizak v'hamazik, then again, a damage on that property would be potter, would be exempt. And finally, Kashahizik, same as our Mishnah, same as the previous Mishnah, similar line, Kashahizik, when this damage occurs, Chov Hamazik Lashalem, Tashlume Nezek, Bemeitav Haaretz. When a person, when this damage is caused, you are liable to pay Tashlume Nezek, Bemeitav Haaretz. Meitav Haaretz, of course, meaning the best of the land, which is something we spent a long time talking about in the last few daf, about Idis, about the best type of land that one has to pay from, etc. And not something we're going to go over in this Mishnah. Okay, just one other thing to note on the Mishnah before we move on, of course, for questions or comments, is just to go, there's a lovely Rashi here, which I think, anyway, the phraseology of the Mishnah, when it talks about hichsharti es nizko, I prepared the nezik, makes it sound like, you know, when you're taking on that responsibility, it's almost like setting aside that money. It's like setting aside the damages in case something happens. I mean, it doesn't mean you have to go as far as that, but it does, at least from a philosophical perspective, present it in that sense. And the question is why? So Rashi actually presents two different approaches, and I think we've touched upon this in the past. I'm pretty sure we've mentioned this, but this is something that's sort of latent throughout these early chapters of Bava Kamma. What exactly is the liability based on? And Rashi presents the two general approaches over here in this second Rashi on the Mishnah. So this is now about halfway down Daf, or halfway down the Omid, I should say. The Mishnah is in bold. The word Matnitin is in bold at the beginning of Rashi, and we're going to jump down to the second, to the line after that, where is the second Rashi on our Mishnah? Hichsharti et nizko. So again, this phrase, I have prepared the nezek. That's what I'm doing by taking on the responsibility. When I have an ox, then I'm expecting that I will have to pay for its damages. Why so? Kolomar im hizik. If this ox caused damage. Hichsharti v'zimanti oso hezek, I have prepared and I am sort of ready to pay this damage. Shalosh shemartiv yofe, because I did not look after it properly. Kach matzasi, right? So says Rashi, the first perspective, he says, based on what he saw, is that your shemira was not good enough. Your watching over it was not good enough. And since you did not watch it properly, you are liable to pay. That's what it's based on. But the second point is subtly different. Lishna acharina, an alternative perspective, another way to phrase it. Hichsharti es nizko, what does that mean? I've prepared this nezek, this damage payment. Olai lahachshir, I have to prepare it. Ulatakein et han et nizko, and to fix the damage that was done. Kolomar ani chayev l'shalei, i.e. I am liable to pay, not because I necessarily was not watching properly, but because the damage was done, in a sense, I have to put it right. It's in a sense, it's almost like an extension of my property. It's almost as though I'm the one who caused damage, I have to set it right. So the question is whether I was lacking in shemira, in the watching that I did, or whether I'm simply liable to put right what was done. And again, they're subtly different. They'll be we've come across a couple of different ways in which I think this plays out, but this sort of latent dual perspective is really within, as I said, many, many elements of the first couple of prokim of Bava Kamma, and we can see it within this phraseology of Hichsharti es nizko, as Rashi very neatly points out. This is one just to bear in mind, we can refer back to it on semi-regular intervals. Okay.
Rabbi, can I just clarify early on, please? With the damage we're talking about, is damage to any property or only damage to land?
Any property, sorry, any property.
So why is it then there's a specific thing about the repayment with damages of best quality land referred to? Because you may not want to receive it. If say you've damaged all my barrels and my pots in my courtyard, why would I want any of your land? I want restitution for my barrels and my pots in the courtyard.
Yeah, so again, but that, so that goes back to what we were talking about before, that how you pay, whether you have to pay in, the point is land was the, land is the, you know, in a sense, the best way to pay, or cash. As we said before, you can take it from money, but the Meita Ha'aretz, the specific point about the Meita Ha'aretz, as we spoke about back on, I think it was Daf Zion, we started talking about that, is that it has to be from the best type of land. That was all the, you know, long discussions we had about having different levels of land. So the Meita Ha'aretz is specifically the Torah's phraseology, expecting that the land payment in this case, if you are paying with land, has to be from the best quality one that you have. As you pointed out, you can pay back with anything. And as we've said, again, I think we talked about this even last week, the fact that we came back to that Gemara which said, afilu subin, even with the sort of worst barley payments, you know, if that's all that you can manage, then that's also going to be the payment type. It can be claimed from anything. Okay, so that's our mission. Tana Rabbana. So our rabbis taught, kol shechavti bishmiroso hechsharti es nisko. So again, quoting our Mishnah, what does that mean? Ketzat. The Gemara wants to know, how exactly does that work? It's going to suggest a case and try and we'll puzzle over it. So ketzat, so let's suggest the following case. And again, this is from a, I'm assuming this is from a brisa. Maybe not. Okay, so the Gemara suggests as follows. Shor ubar, you have an ox or you have a pit. Shem masron lecheresh shotev akotam. And you, so this is again, clear lack of watching over it, because you give it to somebody who is unable to watch it properly. Okay, someone who's unable to watch it properly. For instance, a child, okay, and vehiziko, and it caused damage. So you give your ox over to someone who's not going to look after it properly, and then the damage was caused. Chayiv l'shalem, you are liable to pay because you didn't give it to someone who was obvious that couldn't look after. Chayiv l'shalem, you're liable to pay. Masha ein kein be'esh, but says the Gemara, this is not true with regards to an esh type damage that was done with fire. So now the Gemara is saying, well, what's the difference? The Gemara is going to sort of be a little bit confused. We're going to spend time trying to figure out what exactly is the, why should we distinguish between these two? If we're giving it to someone who is not going to watch it properly, then surely I'm going to be liable, whether it's Aish or whether it's Shor or Bo, whether it's my ox or my, or a pit, or whether it's the Aish type payment. Now again, just a reminder that as we said in the last mission, we have these are categories. Doesn't literally, I mean, we will use these terms because they're the easiest ones to use, but we're talking about categories of types of damage, and all types of damage will fall into one of these categories. So even if technically not with a, I don't know, if you give, let's say, for example, a bow and arrow to a child, right, that's not a fire, that's a bow and arrow, it's a different thing, but again, that will fall under the same category. Okay, so now we're on the fourth line down into the Gemara. But my asking on, what exactly are we dealing with? If you want to suggest Bashar Koshur Ubar Machusa, we're talking about an ox that's tied up, or a pit that has been covered, not covered in the sense that you fall into a covering that people can walk over, right? Like a wooden board or something, right? You cover over this pit with a wooden board. Then, Baruch Hu Dikavosei Gaba Eish, the comparison to Eish would be Gacheres, that you give a coal, right? Simply a coal to this Cheresher to the Koton. Maishna Hocha, Umaishna Hocha. The Gemara wants to know what's the difference between the two, right? They should be identical, i.e., you've given a gacheles is coal. Rashi says she'ino bo'eres ela imkein libo. So it's not currently burning, right? Or maybe a candle is maybe a better an unlit candle. The point is it's not currently burning, but it could cause damage, right? And so too your ox is well tied up and your burr, your pit, is covered, so you should be exempt in all of those cases. Why are we making you liable, or you should be liable in all of those cases? The Gemara says, you know, it seems to be, you basically can't have it both ways. So if we're doing that, Maishnahalcha, what's the difference between the two? Elo b'shur mutar ubur megule. The Gemara suggests, no, we're talking about a case where you gave an untied ox or an open pit, and you said to this child, can you look after it, right? You pulled over a 10-year-old and you said, can you please look after this? The similarity should be to an Eish Shalhevis, where you give them an open flame, right? Something which is already lit up. And since it's already lit up, the Gemara says, Masha'in came ba'ish the potter, right? So why would the exemption apply to this candle effectively, right? Doesn't make any sense. V'ha omer Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish said, Mishmei dechizki in the name of Chizkia, lo shanu ela shem mosar lo gacheles v'liba. So he flips it back around. Right, so he flips it back around again and says that rather we are talking about where you give the child a coal, v'liba, and the child lit it themselves, and that is the case in which we're exempting the owner, right? So again, we're trying to basically match up the three and yet distinguish. So we're basically seemingly creating a case where you have an ox, you have a pit, and you have some sort of fire damage that was caused. And the question is, how likely was it to happen? And yet we're still distinguishing. We're saying in the case of the Shur and Bur, you're going to be liable. Yet in the case of Eish, you're going to be exempt. So first we started with a low level likelihood, right? It was already covered, the ox was tied up, the coal wasn't alight. Then we flipped over and we said, no, in fact, all of them were, you know, ready to damage. The flame was lit, the pit was uncovered, and the ox was not tied up, right? It was free to roam. And then we flipped it back. Okay, so we flipped it back and we're going to try and again draw this distinction. So lo shana ela shemosala gacheles v'liba. So he says, no, but the exemption will be if you give them a coal and it's not lit. Aval shalheves, if you give them an open flame, then you will be liable. My timer, the habari hezekah. So that obviously will be the, so that then in that case, the habari hezekah, then the damage is obvious, and therefore, well, sorry, it's really the Gemara is concluding with a question effectively. My time with the Lebari Hezekiah is saying that's very good, but now we're not really matching it up, right? We're not really matching them up effectively. Obviously, in that case, the damage is clear, right? And in that case, but again, we're not comparing like and like, so we're still struggling to figure out this division. La'olam, the Gemara concludes, or the Gemara is going to sort of now try to, it's basically phrase the problem, and now is going to hopefully present the solution. La'olam, what it must be referring to is as follows. Bashar kosher, we are talking about an ox that is tied up, and bor l'chusa, and the pit that is well covered. Udik v'osei gabi ish gacheles, and again, so similarly, we're talking about something which could cause fire damage but is not actually lit at the moment. Udaka omras, and you know, based on our question, Maishnahocha, why should there be a difference? Why should this Eish potential be exempt, or really why should the other ones be liable? So the Gemara explains, sure, an ox darche lintuke. It is normal for the ox to try and escape, to try and untie itself, to sort of gnaw at the ropes or something, you know, to sort of pull at it and basically try and get out. And therefore, even when it's tied up, you still got to watch it pretty well. And the fact that you left it in the hands of someone who couldn't watch it properly, that was a lack of your watching it. That was a lack of shmira, chosa shmira. You weren't doing your job properly. And what about a bur? A bur darche linture, and again, a pit is liable to become uncovered. You put this board over it, very good. But again, as people wander over it, it sort of slips and begins to move around, and therefore you're still going to be liable to the payment if someone's not watching over it. And therefore, as we said, you're going to be liable in the case of shur and bur. However, you know, with this coal, right? If you leave it, then you know it's going to go out. So it's interesting over here. The Gemara actually uses the phrase ma'amya amya ve'ozla, which makes it sound like it's sort of it's going down, like it's going to burn itself out. But we seem to be talking about a case where it's not actually lit when you give it to them. So that's also an interesting one. You know, the fact that they chose to light it themselves seems to not be the key point here. The point here is that it burns out on its own. Right? So the point here seems to be that it burns out on its own. So I'm not sure exactly why the... I didn't actually have a good answer to that. So as to why, maybe let me explain that question in a moment. Let's just finish up this piece.
Rabbi,
my question on. Yes.
Sorry, excuse me. It must be a glowing ember because only a glowing ember.
So what does libo mean? When Rashi says she'ina bo'eres, says it's not burning.
Well, because an ember doesn't have a flame. It just slowly you know, with oxygen, it will just slowly
burn away.
But I mean, I'm not convinced by that though, because if, for example, the wind were to pick up on its own, it could actually burst into flame without any action by the third party.
Okay, so there you're getting into very interesting. So there's a couple of different things here. Number one is So wind and flame is generally those two things are, when we talk about Aish, I can't remember if we discussed it on the first Mishnah, but that is the sort of key element to Aish, that it has what's called koach acher ma'urav bo, right? That you have to have a third, something else is going to come along that is going to do it. And I guess the question is, how likely is that to happen? I mean, I'm not an ember expert, but it seems to be that, like, if you have an open flame, then that's likely to spread. Whereas the coal, you know, burning coal, okay, but you know, it's still not likely to cause any problems unless unusual wind, you know, a particularly unusual wind, in which case you probably wouldn't be liable. The other interesting thing over here is that we've also sort of, I think it's important to bear in mind in this Gemara that we're talking about where you're handing over the sort of responsibility to someone who you shouldn't be handing over the responsibility to. Meaning, let's take the other person out of the equation, right? Let's say you simply left a burning ember on the ground, or let's say you simply have an animal there, you know, without anybody watching it, and you walk away. So clearly, you're going to be liable in the other two cases, and with the ember, it sounds to me like this is a sort of a key part, right? But in a sense, the cherishot of the cotton is a key part to it. But I wouldn't swear to that.
Rabbi,
I.e., if you left the ember on its own, would you be liable or not?
I think the key thing here is talking about physically transferring that ember. If you left it, let's say it was in a pit, a fire pit, it would extinguish itself. I think what we're talking about here is if he physically takes it out of that safe container or confinement and hands it on to somebody else or transfer it to an unsafe place, that's when the liability would arise, because it was foreseeable that dying
there's
ember
no liability. Sorry, the Gemara says there's no liability in the case of the ember. The Gemara is talking about a case where the Gemara is trying to find a case where we have the shur and the bur where you are liable, and yet the eish you're not liable, right? So we're basically sort of setting the similar level of watching. So we're saying even though you've tied up the shor, even though you've covered over the bor, since that in and of itself is not enough, seemingly. But with regard to the ish, you have done enough, and therefore you would be exempt. So even though you've left someone, as you say, you know, who perhaps is not so trustworthy in this regard, you've left them in charge, you're still actually going to be exempt because ma'amya amya ve'azla. It seems to be, as we said, going out on its own. As Rashi says, u'maydeh libo cheresh, the fact that that this person then lit it up on their own. Lo ramya le debal gacheles la asuke daita. That shouldn't have been something that you would foresee, something that you would expect it to have to be liable for. I think let's come back to this Aish side in a moment. I think what one of the other things that to note. Yes, is it?
It makes a bit life more complicated. We're talking about this transfer from one to the other, but there's no debate or discussion about the basis of the transfer. In other words, what is the other party supposed to be doing or not doing, as the case may be? In other words, you know, you talk about a 10-year-old child, or you're talking about some of the other things that are done, or how, you know, is the protection okay? I'm sorry for making it more complicated, but...
You mean the damage that's done to them?
In other words, when it's handed over from one party to the other party, what's the basis of the handover? In other words, why would somebody hand something over to a 10-year-old child to look at it? I mean, that's just not...
There shouldn't be.
Yeah, so I'm saying is, how is it not important to sort out what the agreement is between the two parties when, you know, when somebody says, here's a pit and I've covered it and it's over to you? What's the basis of that agreement?
Do you think that's right, Rabbi? Because with a shota, presumably you can't form an agreement because they're not capable.
Yeah, I'm not sure what we mean by an agreement. I don't think the agreement makes any difference. The point is, let's put it like this: we're now looking backwards. What's already happened? We're not looking forwards as to whether we're not sort of at the point of the transaction, saying what is going to happen, what is okay to do. We're now at a later point where the damage has been caused, and we're looking back and saying, is someone responsible here? So we look at the child and we say, clearly the child, at least in halachic terms, is not going to be held responsible for the damage that's caused here. So the question is the person who gave it to the child going to be responsible over, you know, going to be held responsible over here or not? So the Gemara is saying that in the case of the shor and the bor, right, the ox and the pit, you are going to be, the owner is going to be held responsible. In the case of the glowing ember, they're not going to be held responsible. Again, regardless, of, as you say, you could have a different discussion as to whether... whether it seems to be, again, the child comes to no harm and all of that, and that's fine. So that's not the discussion. But there was damage caused as a result of the actions that the child took once they had this ember, and the Gemara still seems to say no, that's in a sense too far removed. That's a step further away from because the likelihood was that this is going to go out relatively quickly. It's going to it's going to sort of burn out relatively soon. And therefore, you wouldn't think it's too much of a problem.
But didn't we learn before that if there was a fire and it damaged someone's warehouse and you were negligent in that fire starting, you were liable?
Yes, so that's a fire. So that's what the Gemara is saying.
I agree, but then so the same similarly here. If you move an ember which correctly would extinguish itself, but you moved it in such a way that it created the danger, why would you not be liable?
Because, Andy, you might not move it, might you, Rabbi? You might, for example, if you have a fire in a grate, okay, of an evening, the following morning, actually, you'll see ash in the grate, and you could say, leave a child, you know, in the same room, and an untended fire, and actually, left to its own devices, that fire would just go out. But actually... if you took bellows and you blow wind onto those embers, you can actually get a fire going again.
Yeah, you can.
So you haven't actually moved. You haven't necessarily, in that scenario, you haven't moved the fire. You just left someone in charge of it.
Yeah, but the fire wouldn't cause damage. Okay, it may damage the child if he puts his hand into it, but the fire would reignite in the fire pit where it naturally exists.
No, it wouldn't. But again, but the point is not looking forward. The point is it did. So as Phil said, the child then took the bellows and created the fire as a result of this. So it was there. The potential was there, but it wasn't really going to do anything. The child did then go and create the fire. So there, at that point, the question is, are you liable? And that's, I think that's a very good, maybe that scenario is a great scenario in the sense that the embers were not, and maybe actually that's the distinction that Rashi is saying, that when we say on fire, it doesn't mean literally it's got a flame on it, but a hot glowing hot glowing coal maybe would be considered bo'eret, as in Rashi's terms. That would be considered on fire.
Yeah. Sorry to labour the point, but I still don't see the distinction here, because at the end of the day, if you are doing something as the owner that is potentially going to, via causation, cause damage...
What are you doing as the owner? Sorry, when can we just define that action?
Yeah, what I'm saying is, if we are... I accept if you leave it where it is and someone causes a fire, fine. I'm talking the situation, though, where you're talking about transferring.
When you say transferring, you've not transferred anything.
Well, that's how I'm reading this. They're transferring the embers.
You don't need to transfer it.
Well, this. Well, maybe I'm misreading this. This is
how. No, I think so. Let's clarify. The fact that you leave someone else in charge doesn't mean you need to transfer anything. It means, let's put it like this: you have a barbecue, okay, and you say, "I'm going to the shops now. Okay. You're in charge." Okay, I'm going to the shops now. You're in charge. You haven't transferred anything. It's sitting there. Okay, it's cooling down. You know, you finished cooking everything a while ago, an hour ago. So it's still, there's a bit of heat still left at the bottom under the ash. But the point is, it's cooling down. It's not going anywhere. And you say to your 10-year-old, I'm going to the shop. Again, leaving aside English or whatever, you can leave a 10-year-old now. But assuming going back, we're talking about a couple of thousand years ago. Okay, you say, I'm going, or whatever it is, I'm going to the cow shed to look at the cows, and you're in charge over here. And then you come back, and actually what happened was your 10-year-old went and, took the bellows, or someone else's child, whoever it was, took the bellows and, whipped it up again, and the fire spread and destroyed your neighbor's tree, for example, right? Fruit tree. So that's the question that we're dealing with. And what McMurray is saying here is, yes, is that you would be exempt in that case. Again, the point is that it was cooling down. It's not considered to be a lack of watching over it. And therefore... with your child might be a bit different, actually. So let's leave that aside. But the point is, you left it with someone who probably lacked the responsibility, yes, but it required quite a significant action from them in order to get this going. It's interesting. We're focusing. I thought this was the easier part, actually. I spent more time puzzling over why you should be liable if you leave a tied up ox and a covered pit, right? I thought that was, to me, that was the more striking part of the Gemara. The Gemara says that even though you left your ox tied up and you left the pit covered, but you still, the fact that you left someone who wasn't responsible watching over that is not good enough, and you would actually be liable for that. That there's such an expectation that this animal is going to untie itself, and this pit again will naturally, as I said, the cover will become dislodged as people wander over it. That is that's significant. I guess you basically just have to say that's the scenario the Gemara is dealing with. There obviously will be times where that's not the case. I mean, if you, for instance, I don't know, we're clearly talking about a rope that is tied well, but it's a rope that an animal can chew through. If we're talking about, chains and things, which is impossible or totally out of the ordinary for an animal to get out of, then I would imagine, I mean, I can't put words into the Gemara over here, but based on other sugyas, I would think that would be what the Gemara would call onus, that would not necessarily be liable. So we seem to be talking about a case where it was understood there was a certain level of expectation. And actually, what I took from this is, sorry, this is the only point I wanted to make, is in my conclusion to this, it's very interesting that the Gemara is introducing to us here the idea that you have to come back and check things occasionally as well. You can't just assume status quo continues. I mean, the example I thought of is, like we have to, maybe health and safety has probably gone a bit further than the Gemara's understanding, but certainly there are expectations that you know, nowadays, let's say, if you have a lift or you have a whatever it is, you have something which can cause damage, that there have to be semi-regular checks on that in order to make sure that that it is still safe. You can't just assume that because it was tied up, you know, a year ago, that that's going to continue to be the same. But then are we saying
before you hand over to the showman that the condition that he's safeguarding has got to be initially safe for him to do his job?
Well, I think the point is that the Shamira doesn't count for what I'd like to suggest here is that the Shamira doesn't count for anything, I think is what the Gemara is saying. So you've not handed over to a Shomer, you've not handed over to someone who can watch over it, and therefore, I guess, we're going back to the general liability. Let's say you left it with no one, right? Have you done enough to... I think that's how you have to read this Gemara.
But if you're handing over for safeguarding, then as much as you need to have certainty that the ox is well tied and the pit is covered to begin with, then I would come back again and be a pain and argue that you've got to make sure that your ember is in sufficient safe mode that it can't be reignited. I don't understand why even now they're trying to make this distinction between those three things.
You mean because it should have been foreseeable?
Absolutely. You know, if it's dying out, so you extinguish it. You don't let it go out, you extinguish it. Or you cover it in such a way that it can't reignite.
You know, my honest feeling on this is I think that in the 21st century, we have a very, very high threshold for expectation of leaving things in a manner that, you know, that nothing could possibly happen. I think that the threshold was, or certainly the halakhic threshold, I think is going to be lower than that. You can always, as a society, declare a high threshold. That's also legitimate. And you know, we'd obviously follow the liability based on, you know, generally agreed laws, etc. But in terms of the core human interactions, I think that this is the point is there is an acceptable, I guess, level of risk. You know, there's a normal thing that, you know, you can't put everything out of reach and out of sight and out of, you know, and make it impossible. It was not expected that this would happen, and the fact that it did happen doesn't make you liable. I think. But I think what's also what we're taking away from here is a couple of things. Number one is the fact that, as we said before, the fact that the shur and the bur, even though you had put in a certain amount of, you know, looking after them, you know, making sure that they were covered and tied up, that's not in and of itself. That's not necessarily enough. I think the other point is the fact that handing over to an inadequate shomer, inadequate guard, is also not enough. And again, the final point is that this, specifically with this gacheles, the fact that they go and do something and light it up as a result is considered to be a further extension. As Andy, you could take issue with that in terms of the technicality of where we're drawing the threshold, but that seems to be the threshold Big Mara's drawing, that that since it was cooling down and was unexpected, you didn't think that this was likely to happen, and not just you didn't think this was likely to happen, but this was clearly not something that was expected, then that seems to be again okay. Again, I wonder what is like when we talk about what to expect from children as well nowadays. I also feel like it's a little bit dependent on time and place as well, you know, and in a different society. I feel like our children who have very little, it's just my sense, but our children who have very little exposure to these sorts of things tend to be a lot more excited by it. Whereas once upon a time, probably, I think these things were much more normal, you know, where it was not quite as exciting. Whereas now, I don't know, if my children get anywhere close to a match, then because they're not allowed anywhere near one usually, so it's an immensely exciting thing. They sort of know that that's a chance that is not going to be put near them anytime soon, and therefore that's they're going to seize it with both hands. So I don't know, just an interesting one. I'll give you a different, it's not quite the same thing, yeah, it's not quite the same thing. Well, maybe it is a little bit, in the sense that actually we've had a couple of fun with blocked drains recently, where stones seem to have been thrown down a drain by certain smaller members of the household. And I think that it's got to a point where they know that is going to, you know, make the parents jump up and down, so that becomes, you know, a bit more exciting to throw stones down the drain. I don't think it's that exciting to throw stones down the drain normally, but we've sort of accidentally made it a bit more exciting to throw the stones down the drain. So it could be a similar thing with the flames. As I said, you know, the fact that you know something's going to happen nowadays might make it more exciting, whereas usually it's not the most exciting thing in the world to have a pile of ash sitting there that's cooling down. Anyway, but back to our Gemara. Ula Rabbi Yochanan. Okay, so now we're moving into a slightly different opinion, right? The Gemara is saying, you know, not everybody's going to agree to this. Ula Rabbi Yochanan, to Omar Afilu Mosar Lo Shal Heves. So he takes this a step further. Okay, we were saying, you know, Andy's worried that even leaving the cooling down embers is you know, you should think about whether the child is liable, or the person, sorry, the owner is liable. Rabbi Yochanan takes it a step further. So even giving them a flame, even giving them a candle, for example, they would be potter. Why? So he goes a step further and he says that's the case that we're talking about. The exemption is going to be in a case where where it's an actual candle, so you know, some sort of flame that's in their hand, or a lighted ember, a glowing ember. Hosom Savta de Cheresh Kogorin, Hocha Lo Savta de Cheresh Kogorin. So what Rabbi Yochanan seems to be of the opinion, basically saying that it's the fact that he's holding onto it that is going to cause the damage, right? That is what is going to cause the damage. Aval Hocha, when it comes to the ox that's not tied up and the pit that's uncovered, loads after. It's not about him holding on to anything. It's the fact that it's a lack of shemira, right? In a sense, the pit was just there. The ox, in a sense, was left on its own. The point is, with regards to the flame, it required something else. It required the movement of this cheresh to do it. Now, this leads us on to an interesting question, because usually, let's say let's put it like this. In the classic, going back to the classic categories, right? A bur, we've talked about the bur hamizgalgil, right? A pit that moves. Usually the expectation is that when you put a hazard down in the middle of a street, it stays where it is, and if it damages where it is, then you're going to be liable. If it moves, then you may not be liable. That was the whole discussion about bur hamizgalgil, a bur that gets moved around. An animal obviously moves itself, and with an ash, with a fire, we've talked about koach achemura bur, that there's an expectation of normal wind you'll be liable for, but actually if it's a rosh enamatsu, if it's a particularly unusually strong wind, then again you're going to be exempt. So here, what Rabbi Yochanan seems to be, this is the way I understood it, Rabbi Yochanan seems to be saying that there's no, this is not a kar acher b'urapo, this is not a sort of a natural wind that is blowing the fire over. The point is that something else, someone else has moved it over, and that is, in a sense, that's a step removed, right? It's a step removed, and therefore you'd still be exempt. Now, I think this is definitely a unique opinion. I think he's put a very, very high threshold on liability in this particular instance. And actually, let's see this Rashi. I think Rashi explains it a little bit further. Yeah, okay, so the Rashi, right, the last, there's like medium lines in Rashi. There's thin ones, medium ones, and the long ones. So the very last medium line in Rashi is talking about Ula Rabbi Yochanan. Ula Rabbi Yochanan de Omar. Everybody with me? So Ula Rabbi Yochanan de Omar, Behakones, that's in a chapter later on. I don't remember which chapter. So I think that's in, but we'll come on later on. Afilu Mosar Lo Shalheves Potter, that's his opinion. He says that even if you give the child a candle or some sort of open flame, then you're still exempt. Why? The Hashta Mokila, the Hard Dikatani, Masha Inkain, Ba'esh Bashalheves. He's going back on what we said, that this is obviously dissimilar to sort of this open flame. Or to give us a Chayev Gabeshur Abor. Oh no, sorry, this is not the Rashi I was looking for. I thought okay. Oh no, it doesn't say it clearly over here. Sorry, my misunderstanding. I thought maybe it's not in Rashi. So let's see, do I have any note here? Oh, it's a Rashi later on, excuse me. Okay, so it's a Rashi later on. But basically, there's a whole discussion later on. There's a whole discussion. I don't have the Gemara over here. I have a smaller Gemara, so it's only got part of the Gemara. I don't have the full thing. But on 22b, I have a note here which points me to 22b, Chaf Bet on the Bet, if anybody has it. And I think Rashi there, over there, clarifies that we're talking about, that we're basically Rabbi Yochanan is following the opinion. When we talk about Eish, there's a big debate as to what exactly is the liability with regards to Eish. Is it Mishum Chitzav or Mishum Mamono? So usually with regards to all the other damages, we talk about it being because of ownership, linked to property, Mishum Mamono. But with regards to Eish, some suggest it's Mishum Chitzav, that it's similar to an arrow in a sense, that you fire an arrow away from you, and what is, you know, the expected trajectory of the arrow, you're going to be liable for it, even though you're no longer holding on to it, even though you've forgotten it, you know, it's nothing to do with you. But if there's an expected trajectory of the arrow, anything on that trajectory is going to be going to fall under your responsibility. So too with a fire. When you light the fire, if there's a sort of an expected, as you said, an expected trajectory of that fire, then you're going to be expected. Then that will fall under your level of responsibility. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan here, I think what he's saying is that with a child, in a sense, it can go in any direction, right? You know, the point is that it's not really, or not could go in any direction. You don't expect it to go in every direction, and therefore, actually, he would still say that you're exempt for giving even an open flame, even an open flame. I'm not sure what the, as I said, it still seems to be a very, very high, threshold, you know, or very low threshold, I guess, is the low threshold of exemption. Seems to be very, very easy to get out of this, but that's at least Rabbi Yochanan's opinion. And as I said, Rashi connected to this idea of Isha Mishum Chitzov, that it's linked to the idea of more similar to firing an arrow than it is linked to property, because here, again, it still belongs to you. The fact that you handed it over to someone and that person is not looking after it properly, that is still going to be that's not going to be good enough to get out of it in that case. Okay, so maybe we should, I guess we'll get to that when we get to that Gemara a bit later on. I see here that there is actually interesting, is the debate between Rashi and Tosfot on that Gemara later on, as to what exactly the which category Rabbi Yochanan's opinion is falling into, what exactly his approach is to this point. Okay, just to wrap up back around, I guess we'll start off the next one just briefly, but the presumably we'll follow the more central opinion of this Gemara, which is that in the case of the shor and the bor, then you would be liable even if you cover them, even if you tie them up. And again, the point that even though you're leaving them in someone's responsibility, if that person shouldn't be considered halakhically responsible, then that is no good, it's going to count for nothing. Whereas the cooling down embers, you would be exempt. Seemingly, if you leave a flame, obviously on its own, then you're going to be liable, like a regular case of Aish, even if you give it to someone else who is not halakhically responsible, you would still be liable. Rabbi Yochanan disagrees with that last point, and would, but again, I would think that we reject that, and actually, sorry, I should clarify, that Rabbi Yochanan would also presumably say that therefore this distinction is, you know, in order to match everything up, he's going to push everything up one level. So just as you're not liable in the higher case of Aish, you wouldn't be liable in the lower case of the Shur and the Bur, i.e. if you left them tied up and covered up, then potentially, I'm not going to go as far as that actually, because that's an interesting one. That doesn't sound like that from Russian Tosfot here. Okay, so let's leave that. Let's leave that there. Tana Rabban, six lines from the end, seven lines from the end of the Gemara. Chomer b'shor mibuchor shehashor meshalem et hakofet. So there are certain stringencies with regard to the damages that are caused by a with regards to Niskei Shor, the damages caused by an ox or within that category, than there are as compared to those caused by a pit or within that category. Chomer b'bor mibushar, and so too in the reverse. Okay, so again, they each basically have stringencies which the other one doesn't have. Chomer b'shor mibubur, so the stringencies with regards to an ox as opposed to a pit falling into one category as opposed to the other. Shehashor mishalim esachofer, Shor has to pay double damages, right? Bishloshim shel evet. Sorry, v'chayiv bishloshim shel evet. Nigmar dino osur bahana'a. So the first one is Mishalim Zakofa, that you have to pay double damages. That is when we're talking about it's interesting, it calls it double damages, because that is just talking about, I think, this is talking about killing, where we're talking about that it actually kills a human being. In the case where a shark, where your ox kills a human being, then you have to pay double damages. Chai b'shlosh shekolim shel evet. So again, in regards to the payments due for a servant. Okay, going back to dealing with this is obviously in a scenario where we're viewing this as property, which is obviously not our current outlook. So again, but the point is that in that case, again, the owner would be liable, whereas in the case of a bur, in the case of a pit, there would be no liability. And again, so too with a human being. If a human being dies by falling into a pit, you pay for the damages, you pay for the death, but not double. Whereas if it's gored by an ox, then you pay double damages. V'nigmar dino, and once it's finished, right? Once the ox, as an example, has to be put to death. So then, osur bahana'a, the flesh, the animal itself, is forbidden to be used. V'darko leilech lehazit, and again, as we've said before, the point when it comes one of the significant differences when it comes to an ox is that it's normal for the ox to move, you know, to go places and to cause damage in a different place from where you left it. Mash in came babar, whereas with regards to a pit, then it's unusual for it to move. As we've said, we've mentioned briefly in the past that the concept of babar hamit galgel, but that's always going to be out of the ordinary. And just to finish off, chomer babar mibushar, the stringencies of the pit case as opposed to the ox category, shehabur tchilas masiyas alenezek, when talking about a pit, then it is a hazard from the moment when it's created, right? As I think we've also mentioned this in the past, umuad mitchilas, and it's also considered muad from the start, as we've mentioned in the past. The shor would be exempt, we only have to pay half damages for the first three times that it causes damage, whereas the pit, you're liable for full damages from the very beginning. Masha in came Bashar, as we said, whereas the rules with regards to an ox are different. That's just an introduction. I think we're obviously going to start with that piece of Gemara again next week, 2 weeks. And we'll leave it there for today, if that's okay.
Is the next year going to be a week on Monday? Or?
That is a good question. So the week on Monday is the 21st. The honest truth is, I feel that based on the survey, Wednesday mornings seem to work better for people than Monday afternoons. So if everybody's up for it, then I, and again, I'll go back and check my survey again. But
I can't do Wednesday mornings.
You can't do Wednesday mornings. Wednesday looked like the only day that everybody said they can do.
No, because every other week I do an hour and a half Yiddish conversation with Holocaust survivors.
That's a lot of fun.
They're all in their 90s, and so.